Chapter 12. Elephant Island. The 22 men who had been left behind on Elephant Island were under the command of Wilde, in whom I had absolute confidence, and the account of their experiences during the long 4.5 months' wait while I was trying to get help to them, I have secured from their various diaries, supplemented by details which I obtained in conversation on the voyage back to civilization. The first consideration, which was even more important than that of food, was to provide shelter. The semi-starvation during the drift on the ice floe, added to the exposure in the boats and the inclemencies of the weather encountered after our landing on Elephant Island, had left its mark on a good many of them. Rickinson, who bore up gamely to the last, collapsed from heart failure. Blackborough and Hudson could not move. All were frostbitten in varying degrees, and their clothes, which had been worn continuously for 6 months, were much the worse for wear. The blizzard, which sprang up the day that we landed at Cape Wild, lasted for a fortnight, often blowing at the rate of 70 to 90 miles an hour, and occasionally reaching even higher figures. The tents, which had lasted so well and endured so much, were torn to ribbons, with the exception of the square tent occupied by Hurley, James, and Hudson. Sleeping bags and clothes were wringing wet, and the physical discomforts were tending to produce acute mental depression. The two remaining boats had been turned upside down, with one gunwale resting on the snow and the other raised about 2 feet on rocks and cases, and under these the sailors and some of the scientists, with the two invalids, Rickinson and Blackborough, found head cover at least. Shelter from the weather and warmth to dry their clothes was imperative, so Wilde hastened the excavation of the ice cave in the slope which had been started before I left. The high temperature, however, caused a continuous stream of water to drip from the roof and sides of the ice cave, and as with 22 men living in it, the temperature would be practically always above freezing, there would have been no hope of dry quarters for them there. Under the direction of Wilde, they therefore collected some big flat stones, having in many cases to dig down under the snow which was covering the beach, and with these they erected 2 substantial walls, 4 feet high and 19 feet apart. We are all ridiculously weak, and this part of the work was exceedingly laborious, and took us more than twice as long as it would have done had we been in normal health. Stones that we could easily have lifted at other times we found quite beyond our capacity, and it needed 2 or 3 of us to carry some that would otherwise have been one man's load. Our difficulties were added to by the fact that most of the more suitable stones lay at the further end of the spit, some 150 yards away. Our weakness is best compared with that which one experiences on getting up from a long illness. One feels well, but physically enervated. The site chosen for the hut was the spot where the stove had been originally erected on the night of our arrival. It lay between 2 large boulders, which, if they would not actually form the walls of the hut, would at least provide a valuable protection from the wind. Further protection was provided to the north by a hill called Penguin Hill, at the end of the spit. As soon as the walls were completed and squared off, the 2 boats were laid upside down on them, side by side. The exact adjustment of the boats took some time, but was of paramount importance if our structure was to be the permanent affair that we hoped it would be. Once in place, they were securely chocked up and lashed down to the rocks. The few pieces of wood that we had were laid across from keel to keel, and over this the material of one of the torn tents was spread and secured with guys to the rocks. The walls were ingeniously contrived and fixed up by Marston. First, he cut the now useless tents into suitable lengths. Then he cut the legs of a pair of sea boots into narrow strips, and using these in much the same way that the leather binding is put round the edge of upholstered chairs, he nailed the tent cloth all round the insides of the outer gunwales of the 2 boats, in such a way that it hung down like a valance to the ground, where it was secured with spars and oars. A couple of overlapping blankets made the door, superseded later by a sack-mouth door cut from one of the tents. This consisted of a sort of tube of canvas sewn on to the tent cloth, through which the men crawled in or out, tying it up as one would the mouth of a sack as soon as the man had passed through. It is certainly the most convenient and efficient door for these conditions that has ever been invented. Whilst the side walls of the hut were being fixed, others proceeded to fill the interstices between the stones of the end walls with snow. As this was very powdery and would not bind well, we eventually had to supplement it with the only spare blanket and an overcoat. All this work was very hard on our frostbitten fingers, and materials were very limited. At last all was completed, and we were invited to bring in our sodden bags, which had been lying out in the drizzling rain for several hours, for the tents and boats that had previously sheltered them had all been requisitioned to form our new residence. We took our places under Wilde's direction. There was no squabbling for best places, but it was noticeable that there was something in the nature of a rush for the billets up on the thwarts of the boats. Rickinson, who was still very weak and ill but very cheery, obtained a place in the boat directly above the stove, and the sailors, having lived under the Stancomb Wills for a few days while she was upside down on the beach, tacitly claimed it as their own and flocked up onto its thwarts as one man. There was one upstair billet left in this boat, which Wilde offered to Hussey and Lees simultaneously, saying that the first man that got his bag up could have the billet. Whilst Lees was calculating the pros and cons, Hussey got his bag and had it up just as Lees had determined that the pros had it. There were now four men up on the thwarts of the Dudley Docker, and the five sailors and Hussey on those of the Stancomb Wills, the remainder disposing themselves on the floor. The floor was at first covered with snow and ice, frozen in amongst the pebbles. This was cleared out, and the remainder of the tent spread out over the stones. Within the shelter of these cramped but comparatively palatial quarters, cheerfulness once more reigned amongst the party. The blizzard, however, soon discovered the flaws in the architecture of their hut, and the fine drift snow forced its way through the crevices between the stones forming the end walls. Jaeger sleeping bags and coats were spread over the outside of these walls, packed over with snow and securely frozen up, effectively keeping out this drift. At first, all the cooking was done outside under the lee of some rocks, further protection being provided by a wall of provision cases. There were two blubber stoves made from old oil drums, and one day, when the blizzard was unusually severe, an attempt was made to cook the meals inside the hut. There being no means of escape for the pungent blubber smoke, the inmates had rather a bad time, some being affected with a form of smoke blindness similar to snow blindness, very painful and requiring medical attention. A chimney was soon fitted, made by Carr out of the tin lining of one of the biscuit cases, and passed through a close-fitting tin grommet sewn into the canvas of the roof, just between the keels of the two boats, and the smoke nuisance was soon a thing of the past. Later on, another old oil drum was made to surround this chimney, so that two pots could be cooked at once on the one stove. Those whose billets were near the stove suffered from the effects of the local thaw caused by its heat, but they were repaid by being able to warm up portions of steak and hooshes left over from previous meals, and even to warm up those of the less fortunate ones, for a consideration. This consisted generally of part of the hoosh or one or two pieces of sugar. The cook and his assistant, which latter job was taken by each man in turn, were called about 7 a.m., and breakfast was generally ready by about 10 a.m. Provision cases were then arranged in a wide circle round the stove, and those who were fortunate enough to be next to it could dry their gear. So that all should benefit equally by this, a sort of general post was carried out, each man occupying his place at mealtime for one day only, moving up one the succeeding day. In this way, eventually every man managed to dry his clothes, and life began to assume a much brighter aspect. The great trouble in the hut was the absence of light. The canvas walls were covered with blubber soot, and with the snowdrifts accumulating round the hut, its inhabitants were living in a state of perpetual night. Lamps were fashioned out of sardine tins, with bits of surgical bandage for wicks. But as the oil consisted of seal oil rendered down from the blubber, the remaining fibrous tissue being issued very sparingly at lunch, by the by, and being considered a great delicacy, they were more a means of conserving the scanty store of matches than of serving as illuminants. Wilde was the first to overcome this difficulty by sewing into the canvas wall the glass lid of a chronometer box. Later on, three other windows were added, the material in this case being some celluloid panels from a photograph case of mine, which I had left behind in a bag. This enabled the occupants of the floor billets who were near enough to read and sew, which relieved the monotony of the situation considerably. Our reading material consisted at this time of two books of poetry, one book of Nordenskjöld's Expedition, one or two torn volumes of the Encyclopaedia Britannica, and a penny cookery book owned by Marston. Our clothes, though never presentable, as they bore the scars of nearly 10 months of rough usage, had to be continually patched to keep them together at all. As the floor of the hut had been raised by the addition of loads of clean pebbles, from which most of the snow had been removed, during the cold weather it was kept comparatively dry.